8:30 a.m. KSDP, I'm Kels Hetherington, and this is Meet the People. Today, we are joined on the telephone by Dr. Richard Amerling. Dr. Amerling is an associate professor of clinical medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Well, Professor, with that introduction, a good morning to you, and welcome to the airwaves of Alaska.
Good morning, Kels. It's a pleasure to be talking with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you, Doctor. I wanted to have you on the program this morning because I agree with the concerns that you have raised about the healthcare overhaul that President Barack Obama is again trying to advance on Capitol Hill. Maybe you could start by describing for us why you and so many in your profession are so very concerned about the proposal that the White House is trying to jam through Congress.
All right, Kels, I thought maybe I could just start with about 30 seconds of biographical information so people know who I am. I graduated medicine in the medical school in 1981. I've been practicing medicine post-training for over 20 years. I've also been writing and reading and lecturing on healthcare issues. So I know the healthcare scene quite well, and I know the healthcare politics quite well. And I will happily debate anybody from the Obama administration anytime, anywhere, on healthcare financing and healthcare politics. So I'm not just an average doctor hanging out and practicing who just got involved with this. I've been reading and writing about this for many years. So my concerns are, besides the obvious, that this is going to be budget busting, this is an incredible grab of individual freedom, this inserts healthcare bureaucrats and huge new bureaucracies in between doctors and patients, but they are even going further. There has been an erosion of medical autonomy, physician autonomy, which ultimately impacts on the patient. This has been going on for many years and is a direct result of third-party payment. As the third-party payers cover more and more of the costs of care, they are demanding more and more control over that care. Well, look at what the government has. The government has already 40 to 50% of health care spending. They have Medicaid, they have Medicare, they have CHIP, they have the VA system, they have the Indian Reservation. And by the way, it would be worth looking at how those programs have done. It's not as though we have no experience with government-controlled health care. We know exactly what it's all about. Medicare and Medicaid are bureaucratic nightmares. It's impossible to get any real understanding of the rules and regulations in those systems. They change all the time. The reimbursement is arbitrary and very low, and both systems are heading rapidly towards bankruptcy. So as an example of government-run healthcare, you couldn't really pick a worse system. Mm. So why should we then be turning over the rest of the healthcare system, which is currently under private ownership, at least for the time being, to the government? It just makes no sense. Now, the government is going to be looking to, in very invasive ways, control medical interactions. How are they going to do this? They're going to do this through adherence to guidelines. Guidelines are consensus statements that are put together by usually medical specialty societies under influence from industry, and also the AMA and government has a role in these guideline development panels. And they come up with guidelines that are fairly general. But these are now going to be taken and applied as a rule. And doctors are going to be paid based on how well they comply with these guidelines. And that's called payment for performance. So it sounds like a wonderful thing, but what it really is regimented medical care by the payment system. The electronic health record is then going to provide the real ammunition. They are going to be able to tap into virtually every encounter. They're pushing electronic health records on private physicians with the idea that they're going to be able to look over their shoulder and, in fact, guide therapy. So we're now seeing things taken to a whole new level. There is also the panels that were already enacted into law under the Stimulus Act a year ago, which will pass judgment on what procedures and drugs, et cetera, are medically necessary or so-called cost-effective.
What? You talked about this oversight, and we had someone on late last week who was also a doctor, and she talked very eloquently, as you have, not only in publications far and wide and speeches, but also in the op-ed that you wrote. and you talk about government oversight and this pay for performance. What kind? How is government going to make doctors conform to what they want to do? Are they going to approve what doctors are recommending at the point of service, or is this going to be later on when they're deciding how much they should be reimbursed for a particular procedure?
It's going to be both, but let me give you an example. And by the way, these already exist. They exist in my area, which is nephrology, the care of dialysis patients. The dialysis arena has been heavily government-regulated for many years because it's largely financed by Medicare. It also exists in the United Kingdom, and what they've seen there has been a huge increase in the spending on the primary care physicians and also a lot of iatrogenic disease caused by overzealous treatment, because they've applied these treatment guidelines, for example, of high blood pressure, diabetes, to all patients regardless of their status. And if you treat an 80-plus-year-old for hypertension or diabetes with the same level of aggressivity as you treat a 30- or 40-year-old, you're going to create a lot of complications. And that's what they're seeing there. And I have this from colleagues of mine who practice in that system. But that's the sort of thing that we will see. We'll be treating by the numbers. Here, now, in diabetes management, the glycosylated hemoglobin, or the HbA1c, has been suggested as a way to control treatment. Well, the aggressive pushing down of that sugar number leads to complications, hypoglycemia. Mm. The recent studies have shown that aggressively low targets for glycosylated hemoglobin are associated with actually increased mortality. So this is the kind of danger that you get into by having a guideline-based practice. It's not flexible. It's one size fits all. It doesn't incorporate late-breaking news. And it's the antithesis of what good medical practice should be. That is, it is not an individualized art.
I realize that you specialize in the diabetes field, but what patients and what diseases do you think the treatment of would be most negatively impacted by the passage of the health care reform legislation the way the White House wants it to go?
Well, I think it's clear that they're going to be financing this largely by Medicare cuts. So all the chronic diseases of the elderly are going to be impacted by this in a negative way. Let's start with one that's close to my heart, which is end-stage kidney disease. Now, the treatment of end-stage kidney disease is up for a radical overhaul beginning in January 2011, and I recently wrote an article about this. They are planning to change the way payment is made to the providers of dialysis. This is not the doctors, by the way. This is the dialysis units and the companies that own them. That is going to radically restrict the number of dollars available to treat patients with end-stage kidney disease. So there will be rationing of care, particularly medications, to a lot of these patients. Now, these are the most vulnerable patients you can imagine. They go for dialysis three times or more a week, and they literally are hanging by a thread very often. Mm. So to begin the rationing procedure on this group of patients, to me, is particularly egregious, and I believe it's a warning sign of what's going to come to the rest of the Medicare population.
Well, doctor, if
there's going to be less ability. There's going to be less ability to do bypass surgery, hip replacements, all these things that we have come to depend upon as we age. We expect that these things are going to be there, and they may not be.
Now, what about for patients who are wealthy, who can afford to pay for their own medications out of pocket or medical procedures? Will they be able to get the health care they have, forever?
Well, it depends on how wealthy you are. Certainly, they are talking about raising about taxing the expensive insurance plans, the so-called Cadillac insurance plans. Well, that 40% tax is going to be passed on to the consumer. They're going to pay 40% more for their insurance product. Well, how much money are they going to have left then to pay for things out of pocket? So obviously that option would be a safety valve, if you will, to allow people to get care outside of the system. in much the same way that the Canadians come down here, or up there in your case, to get care that they can't get in Canada because it's so heavily rationed due to the governmental controls.
Well, that's
so I'm hoping that that possibility will remain, though I wouldn't put it past them to make it all but impossible for patients to go outside of the official system or for doctors to practice outside of the official system.
Mm. So you think that doctors who won't follow the prescribed guidelines that the government sets may be restricted from participating at all in the government system?
I think that that is what they would like. I don't know if there's any mechanism in place for them to do that yet, but I can tell you that they do have a mechanism in place that will restrict access to the official system, and that the Secretary of Health and Human Services is going to be passing judgment on what qualifies a doctor as being able to practice within the government-regulated system. And that is going to require them to be adherent to standards of quality. And this language is in the Senate bill. Mm. So what does that mean? It means that they're going to have to follow the guidelines. So if you're not a guideline-type doctor, which means if you're a good doctor and you're treating patients as individuals as opposed to numbers, then you may find yourself unable to treat patients within the system. Now, you know, how much of a market is there going to be outside the system? We don't know. I am with an organization, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. They have been a very loud and active voice for private medical care and independent medical care going back to the 1940s. And they have lots of options available for doctors who are looking to get out of the system. And I think, you know, increasingly doctors are doing that.
Hmm. You know, there are elements of healthcare reform that, as we discussed, were included in a stimulus bill passed last year. And those changes and those new laws will actually not take effect for a few more years. And they include the electronic medical records depository. But what exactly will the changes mean for the patient's experience when they go to see the doctor?
Well, there won't be much obvious change for some time. And this is one of the things that I think is a danger. First of all, much of what has been proposed is not going to kick in for several years. And that was done, I believe, for a couple of political reasons. One, obviously, to have a period where they are just taking in money and not doing anything, which makes their 10-year budget predictions look much better than they normally would. And the other is so that the system won't be dramatically different around the time of the 2012 presidential election. So people will say, oh, well, the healthcare reform really wasn't that bad after all. That's because they haven't seen any of the effects of it yet. So initially, not much is going to happen.
Yep.
Now, the computerization issue is something that they're trying to roll out. It will take, obviously, a long time. They are offering substantial bribes to doctors to buy into the electronic health record. And look, there's nothing wrong with having a computer to run your office and handle your medical records. The issue I have with it is, this should be your own private health record. It shouldn't be available to government bureaucrats.
Mm. So the medical depository that has been established in the stimulus legislation that was passed into law last year only sets into law that there will be a depository. It doesn't say that they're going to actually review what doctors prescribe and the procedures that they recommend to their patients.
No, that's my understanding. And I believe that that is the goal, that is the idea of having data collection and to have it at such a micro level, to me means that they're looking for ways to not only observe what people are doing in their office, but also eventually influence what they're doing. And systems are available for that. You can install a treatment algorithm into a electronic health record that would guide the clinician through the accepted guidelines for various disease states and sort of guide his therapy.
Yesterday, the White House gathered doctors in the White House press room around the president, and he rallied support for his health care plan. As you can imagine, there was lots of clapping and feelings of political support were expressed. Is it possible that some doctors will actually be helped by the passage of healthcare reform, maybe some of the subsectors of the medical profession?
Well, there is a fair amount of support for reform. There is a significant number of doctors, largely academics, I believe, who support the single-payer concept. I don't know very many treating physicians who actually are in private practice who support that, although some do. Some say that they've had it up to their ears with the private insurance companies, and they would welcome a single payer. What I tell them is that single payer could end up being something like Medicaid, which means you're only going to get $7 or $20 per visit. You're not going to be able to stay in business. Now, what doctors might be helped? It's an interesting question. I would look at it this way. Government-controlled education, what does that do? Well, it has created a very heavily regulated system whereby teachers are hired and are almost impossible to fire. There is no real mechanism in place to reward superior teachers. All you need to do is stay in for a few years and you get tenure, then it's almost impossible to fire you. Now, in a competitive environment, very few parents of children would elect to send their kids to schools where the teachers are poor. But, of course, they don't really have a choice here because the government has a monopoly. My feeling is that in a government-run system, like they have in the United Kingdom, the doctors get assigned a bunch of patients, and they get the same number of patients whether they're good or bad. So you don't have to be particularly good to have a big practice. In a competitive system, which we still have here, which is one of the reasons why American healthcare is so good, you have to be a good doctor if you want to have a large clientele, because people hear about you. Mm-hmm. If you're bad, you don't treat your patients well, you keep them waiting, you don't return phone calls. If you're not particularly sharp, that gets out too, and all of a sudden you don't have much of a practice. So I believe that a government-run system would benefit mediocre physicians. And, I've never seen that written, but that's my gut feeling about it.
I base
that on certain HMOs that I have observed. The HMOs tended also to feed primary care physicians a large number of patients, regardless of their real qualifications.
Yeah. What do you see healthcare reform, if passed by Congress, and I'm talking about the insurance portion of it that's currently being discussed? Some elements have already been adopted in the stimulus legislation that was passed last year. But the insurance portions, what are they going to do to the potential lifetime earnings of a doctor who is graduating today in 2010? In 2010, excuse me.
Well, my understanding is that they are going to define an insurance policy from ground up. They're going to define how much can be charged in terms of premiums, who must be covered, what services will be covered. Now, many states do this right now, New York State being one of the worst. They have mandates for coverage of all sorts of things that most people would probably never want to use. But if you want to buy insurance in New York, you have to pay a very high premium to get all of these things that you would probably not use. What will it do to doctors' income? Well, we have the example of Massachusetts, which has a mandatory policy for health insurance and guaranteed issue, meaning the insurance companies have to accept all comers. And they've had to raise their premiums tremendously over there to cover that kind of a mandate. And they've compensated by restricting payments to doctors, to providers. So I would expect that doctors' payments under a government-mandated insurance system would decline over time.
Mm. Now, you mentioned the system in Massachusetts, and it has not been very much talked about by the Obama officials as they have gone around and promoted this health care reform package. Why hasn't it been really much discussed, and how has the system in Massachusetts functioned?
Well, that's why it hasn't been discussed much, because it's been something of a disaster. It's been extremely expensive. The state costs have skyrocketed. The insurance premiums have skyrocketed. There are now delays in getting care. Payments to physicians and hospitals are being constrained. So Massachusetts, which was and still is in some ways a center of excellence in terms of their hospitals and their medical schools, is at risk of becoming like the United Kingdom. They're going to become a second-rate state in terms of medical care. So that's why it hasn't been discussed, because it's really not worked out very well. And for the same reason, they don't really discuss Medicaid and Medicare or the National Health Service or the Canadian system.
Mm. You know, something has to be done because we have 30 or 40 million Americans who are not covered. Clearly, I think we agree that this plan that has been proposed by the White House and this president is not the right solution. What would you, as a doctor of, you know, considerable years in the business, recommend as a solution? If you were the president, what plan would you advance?
It's really not that hard, and the Republicans have been talking about this. They have this on websites. Other people have talked about it. Let me first start by saying that the 30 or 40 million number is debatable. Quite a few of those are aliens. Others are young people who simply choose not to buy insurance and otherwise who could afford it. A good number are people who would qualify for one of the public systems that's already out there. So the number that I've heard is more like between 6 and 12 million. Now, how would you insure them? Well, the answer is competition. Make insurance competitive. Instead of forcing insurance companies to cover everything, allow insurance companies to offer packages that people actually want. Most people are healthy. Most people don't need a lot of health care. They would be best served by a high deductible policy that covers catastrophic illness or accident. And they ought to be able to pay $1,000 or $2,000 or even $3,000 of deductible out of pocket. Now, most people are never going to come near spending that amount of money. To fund that, they ought to be able to put money in a health savings account that will float year to year and accumulate value, and which will be their property. And so, therefore, routine care, let's say an office visit to a doctor, what's it going to cost? $100, $150, $200, have them pay that out of their health savings account. Why should you submit an insurance bill for a $50 office visit? It really doesn't make any sense. So all the routine care should be taken care of in this way. And only the extraordinary care, the operations, the big expenses, that should come under insurance. That simple reform would make a whole lot of difference. Mm. Giving the tax subsidy to the individual as opposed to a company would also increase competition in the insurance industry. Currently, the tax preference to the employer, which dates from price controls during World War II, gives the employer an incentive to give part of your compensation package as health insurance benefits. And that is one of the origins of the whole problem, is that it created this whole need for first-dollar coverage. People became incentivized to use their health coverage every year. If they didn't use it, they sort of don't make as much money. You know, so there was a built-in incentive there to overuse the system. If you transfer the tax break to the individual, have the individual shop for a health insurance plan, buy something that they need as opposed to something that they're being forced to buy, the cost of insurance is going to come way down. A catastrophic plan for a young, healthy person should be very cheap. For people with pre-existing conditions, there is the assigned risk pool mechanism that has been discussed. So there are a lot of ways of doing this. I think that the government has driven up costs by reducing competition and by imposing mandates. The Obama plan continues with all this stuff. It doesn't change any of that. It doesn't change any of the incentives to overspend on health care.
Mm.
So there are very straightforward, simple, free market-oriented solutions, patient-oriented solutions that are out there, but the Obama administration, the Congress, are not interested. This is simply for them a way to extend their power over the American citizen, and they hope assure a permanent liberal majority in Congress and in the presidency.
I completely agree. Just in our final moments, Dr. Amerling, I have a follow-up question on what I just asked you, and that is, what would you think of a plan to, in effect, not have a plan if you outlawed insurance for, you know, the office visit and the menial, the smaller things that people would go to the doctor for, prescriptions and, you know, the odds and ends and only have, in effect, catastrophic insurance, that would force doctors and medical companies to offer products at prices that people could actually afford to pay. Would that be a plan that you would support?
I think that would be a step in the right direction. I don't know if you need to outlaw it. I actually am recommending to colleagues who are able to do this to simply stop accepting insurance as full payment from the majority of their patients and negotiate a fair price with them. No one really squeals too much about going to the dentist and paying them up front, or going to see a lawyer, paying them up front, or when the plumber comes to fix your leak, you don't submit the bill to your insurance company. So everything else, every other good or service, is paid for directly. We have this mistaken notion in this country that there's a right to health care and that therefore it ought to be somehow free. This notion is very destructive, and we have to get away from that and go back to the idea that medicine is a good like anything else and is, to a certain extent, going to cost money. Nothing is free.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the radio and talking with me and our listeners about the proposals that are floating around Congress coming from the Obama administration. You've been listening to Dr. Richard Amerling of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Anything else that you want to add, Doctor?
Well, I would like to say that it's not too late to block this from going through the reconciliation process. I understand that there are a handful of representatives who have not yet decided, and they can be pressured. A lot of websites available that have their contact information, and I think it's really worth it for you to contact these folks and let them know in no uncertain terms that you don't want to have the government controlling their health care.
I think contacting your representative in your district makes a lot of sense. They're listening in a different kind of way, especially after the result in Massachusetts, where Senator Brown, you know, won in this major upset. And I think that if the Democrats do manage to force through by reconciliation some kind of Obama health care reform, they are going to be wounded politically and may suffer deep, deep losses in the November election. So I think you're right. Writing and contacting your member of Congress may do a lot of good to help block this from going through.
It's certainly worth a try. It's incredible to me that we're at this point where the government is flagrantly going ahead and disobeying the will of the people on this very key issue. Americans are freedom-loving people, and they've never wanted socialized health care.
Well, thank you again so much for your time and helping us to better understand the issue that is being considered by our members of Congress.
My pleasure, Kels. Good talking to you, and good morning over there.
All right. Thanks. 8:30 a.m. KSDP. That is Meet the People for March the 4th, 2010. I'm Kels Hetherington. That was Dr. Richard Amerling. He is an associate professor of clinical medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. We'll now go back to music, and then at the top of the hour, we'll get some news from NPR in Washington, D.C.